and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, after weeks of negotiations, New York's $254 billion state budget is finally a done deal. Lawmakers gave it the green light late Thursday night, setting the stage for major policy shifts and spending priorities across the state. We'll find out what's in and what's out, including a provision that many New Yorkers could soon face involuntary hospital stays under the plan that toughens mental health commitment rules. Local economist James B. Huntington is here to break down the latest unemployment numbers in our area, why some classic toys are now worth stealing, and what's behind the temporary tariff cuts with China. Plus, Cats is coming to Liberty, but it's not what you think. And Dr. Hope Lecker is here planting seeds of joy and community in the community wherever she goes. That's coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Stocks opened sharply higher this morning as the U.S. and China agreed to a temporary break from triple-digit tariffs. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average soared 1,000 points in early trading.
The U.S. is slashing tariffs on imports from China from 145% to 30% for the next 90 days. In exchange, China is temporarily cutting its tax on imports from the U.S. to just 10%. The move is a relief for many businesses that rely on Chinese imports. The earlier triple-digit tax had brought much of the cargo traffic between the two countries to a standstill. The remaining tariffs are still significantly higher than Americans were used to paying, however, and because the tariff relief has an expiration date while negotiations continue, there's still considerable uncertainty over what the trade landscape will look like in 3 months. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says he may speak to China's president by the end of this week. President Trump is speaking right now at the White House. He is poised to sign an executive order that he claims will cut prescription drug prices between 30% to 80%. The president tried to do this in his first administration, but he was blocked by the courts. The program was later ended by then-President Biden. President Trump is leaving today for his next foreign trip. He'll spend 4 days in the Middle East, including in Qatar. NPR's Franco Ordonez says there's been a lot of questions about a potential gift from Qatar.
And just this weekend, the White House acknowledged they're in discussions with the Qataris about possibly accepting a luxury plane that could serve as a temporary Air Force One until the new one is finished.
NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting. The White House released a statement saying that any gift given by a foreign government is always accepted in full compliance with all applicable laws. But many critics, including Democrats, say the Constitution forbids any president from accepting such presents without congressional approval. A Kurdish militant group that's waged a 40-year insurgency in southern Turkey, Iraq, and Syria says it is disbanding. Duri Buskerin reports on the end of the PKK.
In a statement to a pro-Kurdish news outlet, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, announced it would disarm and end its armed struggle as part of a peace deal with the Turkish government. Although the PKK expressed willingness to disband after a request by its imprisoned leader in February, the Turkish military continued airstrikes on their positions in northern Iraq. Over the weekend, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his government is getting closer to the goal of a, quote, terror-free Turkey. The PKK launched its insurgency against the Turkish state in the early 1980s, citing poor treatment of Turkey's Kurdish minority. The conflict has caused thousands of deaths in the more than 40 years that have followed.
You're listening to NPR. Hamas says it will release a hostage today who has dual American and Israeli citizenship. Idan Alexander is expected to be transferred to the International Committee of the Red Cross, then taken to an Israeli hospital. Separately, a Hamas official, speaking anonymously, told NPR Alexander is being released in return for unspecified things that the U.S. has promised. No details have been released, but the official hinted it might mean the release of more Palestinian prisoners and fresh aid delivered into Gaza. Israel has released a statement. It says that Israel has not committed to a ceasefire of any kind, but only to a safe corridor to allow Alexander to be released. The United Kingdom's prime minister announced an overhaul of his country's immigration rules. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
It'll be harder to get work, family, and student visas to the UK. Immigrants will have to pass a higher level English test, and most will have to spend at least 10 years here before even applying to settle in the UK, rather than 5 years, as is the case now. In a speech, Prime Minister Keir Starmer says,
"Make no mistake, this plan means migration will fall."
It'll also limit employers' ability to hire overseas workers for low-skilled roles. Starmer says these measures are needed to maintain social cohesion, drive investment in the local workforce, and prevent Britain from becoming a, quote, island of strangers. But this plan also comes just after a far-right anti-immigrant party made big gains in municipal elections. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Again on Wall Street, the Dow is up 1,000 points. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The New York State budget has finally passed. State lawmakers wrapped up voting on the $254 billion state spending plan late Thursday night. Jimmy Vielkind and Jung Young Han of the New York Public News Network break down what's in and what's out.
Hi, Jung Yoon.
Hi, Jimmy. So we finally have a budget. This is 2 weeks after Governor Hochul announced a quote-unquote general agreement. So what were some of the final details that you saw in this?
Well, there's always surprises in the final budget. And one thing that caught my eye was a change to the standards for non-public schools, which includes religious schools. This was really driven by some ultra-Orthodox Jewish yeshivas in Brooklyn and the lower Hudson Valley. Now, all private schools in New York for a long time have had to show that they're, quote, substantially equivalent in subjects like reading and math to public schools. But enforcement of that law, which has been around for decades, has been really both lackluster and tricky. So even though that's a very small number of schools, it's a very politically potent group. So in New York, Orthodox Jewish communities tend to vote as a bloc at the recommendation of their leaders. And politicians from both the Republican and the Democratic parties really court them seriously. In this instance, we understand that Governor Hochul and Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie both pushed for and supported this change.
So what does the change do?
Well, it does two things, really. Non-public schools have to show that they're substantially equivalent through one of seven paths. This would create a new pathway, which would allow a school to use standardized tests that aren't necessarily approved by New York, but they're approved by other states. It also gives schools more time, as much as 7 years from the current school year, according to one advocacy group that opposed these changes. And now, Jung Yoon, you were watching what lawmakers were doing for prison policy in the budget. So what ended up happening?
Well, the governor succeeded in her push to lower the age for hiring corrections officers from 21 years old to now 18. There was also a separate effort to expand the ways that prisoners can earn time through doing good behavior during their sentences for earlier releases, but that didn't come together. One thing that did push through, though, is the state decided to allocate money to cover the cost of the unlawful 3-week prison strike that we saw earlier this year. And it's $685 million. So about $150 million is going to go to pay increases for staff workers in prisons. That was part of the deal that came from the prison strike. And then $535 million just to cover the cost of that 3-week prison strike.
So I remember that some lawmakers wanted to close the Marcy Correctional Facility. That was what happened before this strike started. And Marcy is where Robert Brooks, an incarcerated person, was beaten to death last year. Mm-hmm. So is that going to happen? Are they going to close Marcy?
That's not for sure. The budget gives the governor the power to close up to 3 prisons, and it doesn't name which ones, if at all, if she decides to go through with this. But that will come later this year. In terms of Robert Brooks, actually, we are going to be hearing more about his death and what should be done after that through a special hearing that lawmakers are going to hold on May 14th. These lawmakers from the State Assembly and Senate have been calling for it because they've been concerned by the increased violence that we've seen in prisons. They're hoping that this hearing will rebuild some momentum to pass criminal justice reforms. But there's only a few weeks before the legislative session ends, so Jimmy, what other issues do you think will bear watching?
Well, I'm going to be interested in physician-assisted suicide or medical aid in dying. That bill recently passed the Assembly, and the big question is whether it's going to be taken up by the state Senate. And we're starting to see lobbyists on both sides of this issue showing up in force at the Capitol. Mm. The other is a measure called the New York for All Act. This would essentially provide a sanctuary state policy, which would restrict how local police departments cooperate with federal immigration officials. That's been around for a few years, but it's gaining more urgency with President Trump's deportation campaigns. So both legislative leaders in the Assembly and Senate have said they'll take a look at it, and we're going to have to see what they do.
Okay, we'll be watching for that. Thanks, Jimmy.
Talk to you soon. Take care.
And now, a closer look at a provision in the state budget expected to lead to more New Yorkers being involuntarily committed to hospitals. The changes to New York's involuntary commitment law will make it easier for authorities to hospitalize individuals with mental illness against their will and will impose stricter requirements on hospitals before releasing them, including the need for a treatment plan. Elise Klein with the New York Public News Network dove into the mental health crisis in the state and how it impacted budget negotiations this year.
In Albany, state lawmakers have many mental health priorities, but so far this year, they have spent a lot of time focusing specifically on involuntary commitment. Governor Kathy Hochul first proposed this issue with a policy change to involuntary commitment laws during her executive budget proposals this year. The governor wants to make changes to existing policies like Kendra's law. The change would allow individuals to be involuntarily committed if they are at significant risk of physical harm when their mental illness prevents them from being able to meet basic needs such as food, shelter, and medical care.
This is about showing humanity for fellow human beings who are suffering from mental illness that is literally putting their lives and perhaps the lives of others in danger.
Some state Republican leaders agree with the governor's plans, saying the state has moved towards a deinstitutionalized setting.
We have turned our backs on the mental health system here in New York. We have let it atrophy, decay, dismantled, whatever term you want to use. And when we talk about the increases in crime and the increases in instances of crime, a lot of that, homelessness, a lot of that can be traced back to mental health.
Bridget Gannon, a psychiatric nurse practitioner supportive of the policy, says there are limitations within the system. She says the limitations do not allow New Yorkers to get proper treatment for mental health disorders like schizophrenia.
I think we are not doing a good job. We're failing as a community, helping people that really are having acutely psychotic episodes getting the help they need.
However, some Democrats and many mental health advocates are outraged by the governor's proposal. They argue the proposal would criminalize and exile individuals struggling with housing and/or mental health challenges rather than address their needs. Harvey Rosenthal, CEO of Alliance for Rights and Recovery, says it's problematic to focus on police approaches.
So the way it's set up, the police would be, who are not trained to make these assessments, would make an assessment of someone who's struggling and say, A, they have a mental illness, and B, being in a psychiatric hospital involuntarily is going to not only stabilize that, but help them get food, shelter, and clothing. Hospitals don't give out food, shelter, and clothing. And people can be stabilized in non-medical, non-hospital facilities, which the governor has funded.
Ruth Lowenkron, the director of disability justice at New York Lawyers for the Public Interest, says the governor and lawmakers shouldn't legislate based on isolated incidents.
And where we as advocates together say that she is confused is in suggesting that it is people with mental disabilities who are causing the unrest, who are causing that public safety concern. It's simply not true.
Lowenkron adds data demonstrates people with mental health challenges are no more likely to be violent than people without those challenges. Lowenkron also highlights data showing involuntary commitment to be ineffective. Assemblymember Joanne Simon, a Democrat representing parts of Brooklyn and the chair of the Mental Health Committee, says lawmakers and the executive office should look at the failure of New York City's recently implemented involuntary removal directive.
I think the fundamental problem I see with the proposals this year is, for the most part, the emphasis has been on something that we know to not be terribly effective, that we know from at least the biggest pilot that's been run on this in New York City, not effective.
According to a report from the New York City Council, the 2022 directive undermines support for mental health programs with evidence of improving outcomes. The key findings showed stark racial disparities with the policy and a lack of data demonstrating the practice's effectiveness. It also showed a disconnection to long-term care and an abuse of power, more often removing people from private residences than public spaces. New York State Office of Mental Health Commissioner Dr. Ann Sullivan argues against some of the existing research.
I don't think there's any good research on one particular one way versus the other, but it's important, I think, to note that just as there's anecdotal individuals who will say that this didn't help, there are tons of anecdotal individuals who say, thank you for helping me because I really wasn't able.
Gannon says she has seen firsthand the need from families who want to get care for their loved ones who aren't able or willing to help themselves. Gannon also emphasizes protecting patient autonomy is incredibly important, saying the Nurses Association doesn't want to see any disruptive changes to the current standards of Kendra's law. The law, which was enacted in 1999 in response to the death of Kendra Webdale, who was pushed in front of a subway train by a man with a history of mental illness.
Yeah, you have to determine two things, whether or not they have the capacity, the medical decision-making capacity to decide whether or not they can go to the hospital, and also whether or not they're at acute risk of hurting themselves or others. And we are not asking to change those professional standards. Again, they're incredibly important in terms of protecting patient autonomy.
Some lawmakers say they need to shift their focus away from this particularly controversial issue. Simon says they should instead focus on filling in the gaps when it comes to challenges within the state's mental health services.
We need to provide the services, we need to provide the staffing, and we need to provide the access to supported housing.
Glenn Liebman, the CEO of the Mental Health Association in New York State, agrees, saying lawmakers should be putting funding towards staffing and community services.
I think that's where we need to go, because if you force people to treatment, ultimately, if there are no services there, what's going to happen? They're going to go back into the system and eventually, you know, end up back again in the hospital, in crisis services, in prison, in jails or homes. We have to make sure that those services are in place for them.
Liebman says his top priority as an advocate is pushing for an increased cost of living adjustment for the workforce. He also stresses the mental health workforce is in crisis right now.
We continue to lose staff to other entities. We can't pay a great deal of money because we don't have a lot of money. So essentially what happens is that people in our field end up going to the Walmarts, the McDonald's, the Amazons, because we can't keep them.
Liebman and other advocates are fighting for a 7.8% investment in the cost of living adjustment, or COLA, which they say hasn't been substantially funded in about a decade. Liebman says if funded to a 7.8 increase, the COLA will help stabilize the mental health field. Mary Sidnor, the director of the residential treatment facility at Parsons Child and Family Center at Northern Rivers, says keeping good workers is a continued concern.
I worry about myself. I worry about my staff and whether they're going to be able to, you know, because that's more on me if I can't retain my good, talented staffs.
Sidnor adds that good workers improve the quality of patient care.
It impacts every part of the program when we lose good staff, and we want to be able to give them quality care.
Simon says lawmakers in both houses support increasing the cost of living adjustment.
It doesn't matter how many beds you have if you can't staff them.
State Senator Anthony Palumbo, representing parts of Suffolk County and a ranking member of the Mental Health Committee, says the workforce is the backbone of the industry.
So mental health needs to always be a priority. And the fact that they've been underfunded for so many years systemically, that we need to really make up that difference, because we need to make sure that they have the workforce to address the needs that are necessary.
Sullivan says the workforce is vital to the needs of mental health services. She also says addressing these challenges requires a multifactorial approach. She says one other way to help the workforce is to incentivize education.
So one of the big things that we have is a loan repayment program. And the loan repayment program provides loan repayments now for psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, social workers, psychologists, certified mental health counselors, the entire mental health workforce. And currently, we have had almost 1,000 individuals pick up that loan forgiveness program, which means it's 1,000 individuals who have now getting loan repayments, but have committed to work a minimum of 3 years in the public sector system. So that's tremendous.
The commissioner also says support for helping the workforce is growing.
Mental health services across the nation have always been in short supply in terms of being able to be there to serve people. But I think we're getting a lot of support.
The commissioner, along with lawmakers, workers, and mental health advocates, are also hoping to see an increased support and investment in peer support services.
But we need more and more peers in the workforce. They are a tremendous impact.
Gannon says peer support is incredibly helpful for people with mental health challenges.
I've seen it firsthand that peer services work really well, and we certainly need to invest in more peer resources.
Sullivan says one of the ways the state currently provides peer support is through intensive and sustained engagement teams, or INSET teams. Sullivan says access to these services is most beneficial via insurance coverage. She says this is an area where she'd like to see the state expand.
It's growing. There are some commercial payers who will pay. Medicaid will pay. But it's critical that it be a service that's available for individuals. And you make it most available often when you have insurance coverage.
Some lawmakers say another way to address mental health needs is through a rural suicide prevention council. Simon says lawmakers need to find a way to prevent suicides and help New Yorkers with limited access to resources in rural areas.
They just have a real lack of access. And so why is this a problem in rural communities? What are the things giving rise to it, and how can we address this?
The bill to establish this council has bipartisan support and passed last year in both chambers. However, it was later vetoed by the governor. State Senator Pam Helming, a Republican representing Ontario, Wayne, and Livingston counties, and the lead sponsor of the bill, told WMHT she was confused by the governor's veto.
I was floored. I didn't understand the reason why, and she vetoed it in a stack of with other bills. So it's still not clear. There was some talk about the fiscal impacts of the bill and that it needs to be done through the budget process. However, the bill creates basically an all-volunteer task force, so there really isn't significant or substantial funding that is necessary or needed.
Helming says the bill, if signed into law, could address barriers in rural areas that often don't get the same attention as larger cities in the state.
This bill would really help us drill down and pinpoint what is standing in the way of people living in rural communities getting the services that they need.
Helming says the bill passed last year at the end of session, so she is optimistic lawmakers can get it across the finish line in both houses once again. Lawmakers have about a month left before they adjourn the legislative year to get bills like this passed and other mental health policy measures. The final budget language amended the state's mental hygiene laws, making small changes to definitions such as in need of involuntary care of treatment and the likelihood to result in serious harm. The budgetary changes are in line with what the governor wanted, allowing individuals to be involuntarily committed if they are at a risk for serious harm. The budget changes also include pieces of what lawmakers wanted, ensuring continued care. This includes discharge obligations such as requiring reasonable efforts are made to promptly notify any community provider or mental health services that maintains the individual on its caseload. In addition, the language also requires the facility to advise the individual of clinically appropriate aftercare services and, for individuals with complex needs, coordinate discharge planning with the care management program and provide referrals to community services such as resident programs and peer-based programs. In Albany, I'm Elise Klein for the New York Public News Network.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, James B. Huntington is here with a local economic perspective, including some unemployment numbers in our region. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, I'm Kusar Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me. The Music Emporium. Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels. Small batch handmade New York style bagels in Roscoe, New York. GrizzlyBagels.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Monday, and local economist and author James B. Huntington is here to help us unpack a range of economic issues. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Let's start off with some local unemployment rates. What are the most recent unemployment numbers in our region?
Yes, well, these are from March. We have Sullivan County with 3.9% unemployment, Orange County also 3.9%, Ulster County 3.8%, Wayne County 4.7%, and Pike County 4.8%. Those have gone down an average of 0.5% since February's numbers. The national unadjusted unemployment rate was 4.2%, down 0.3%. So as you can see, the New York counties all did better, and the Pennsylvania ones, though, are lagging. They're a little bit behind then. So we're still in good shape, but we had a larger drop in unemployment from February to March than we did nationwide. So that looks good for us.
All right. Well, let's talk about interest rates. The Fed's rates have remained pretty steady. What impact is this stability having on investment behaviors and borrowing? What's happening with interest rates?
Well, it's stayed the same for their meeting last week, which is the third week in a row. So as far as the effect on investments, we'll see. We have some large increases in the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones Industrial Average today.
Yeah.
A lot of that is probably due to the tariff situation with our president's decision to put most of the tariff amounts, but not all, with China on hold. So instead of being 145%, it's 30%. The last week was fairly flat, as I'll probably get to later in this program, but it very much liked the news that came out this weekend with the tariffs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. We've been hearing about the tariff rate cut with China, the temporary tariff cuts, all morning. They've agreed to this 90-day suspension. It looks like it's impacting the markets, as you see right there in real time. How does this temporary rollback affect consumers, though? Is it going to make it easier to plan and buy?
Well, you probably know the drill on this one. Items that are subject to tariffs will go back down in price, if in fact they ever went up. It was such a short time, it's hard to tell sometimes if businesses really updated all their websites with higher prices or not, whatever the case may be. But obviously lower tariffs mean lower prices for consumers. We have no idea with the government we have how long these temporary reprieves will last, or even if they'll be temporary. They are a lot higher. The tariffs with China are still a lot much higher than they were when Trump took office. So we don't have any kind of real improvement, permanent improvement, and 30% is still quite substantial. We saw the example of a $10 T-shirt going up to $24.50 with the 145% tariffs. Well, now it would be 13 instead of 10. That's still a significant amount, and you should expect that most people selling things are going to add the cost of the tariffs right on to the retail price.
And let's talk about the job market. What are some trends, new trends we're seeing in job seeking and hiring?
Well, we have a couple things that came out from Business Insider looking at 2025, this year and beyond, some changes or reinforcing of previous trends. Number one, their number one prediction is that new approaches to hiring will help navigate economic uncertainty, that there will be fewer jobs, or rather, there will be fewer employees with the immigrants, legal and illegal, being turned away so often, and with the population aging. So employers may be working harder to find the workers they want. Number two, we have work well-being will be a key bottom line strategy. That's been improving, especially as Generation Z gets older and older and further into the workforce. They're the people who want some extra things, some things that will help them generally feel better at work, about work, happiness, job satisfaction, lack of stress, and sense of purpose. This trend has been slowly growing for decades now. It's quite a contrast to what workplaces were like for baby boomers like me, where it was generally just do your job and don't expect anything, any warm, fuzzy sorts of things, as we might have called them. But now they're getting to look more and more necessary. And number three, AI will have a big impact, but it will vary by industry. Artificial intelligence, we don't really know what it's going to be capable of in any time in the future, but it is moving along quickly, and there probably will be positions that will be cut back because AI can do things just as well and cheaper in some ways than workers can. Most of the effect will be concentrated in, they say, sectors with a reputation for quickly adopting new technologies like software development and mathematics.
Yeah. All right.
So some areas will not be affected much. Some will be affected a lot. We'll just have to see what happens with AI and how fast it actually progresses.
Yeah. Let's talk about this classic toy story. Some high-value toys that are in such high demand, they're being targeted by thieves? What's going on? And what's the toys?
Yes. Well, the toy is Lego.
Oh, wow.
And some Lego sets have gone up so much in value, they have gaps even at times between what the retail people are selling them for and what they can sell on the secondary market. It's reminiscent of Beanie Babies in their late 1990s peak, where they get gobbled up very quickly when they arrive at certain stores that have a lot of them, because people can get double or more than that by just putting them on eBay. And what we have here is a real problem with them being stolen. The dollar values are often a lot higher. I mean, a big Lego set can cost a few hundred dollars. So if you have an armload of them, that could be worth quite a lot. We have the Bricks and Minifigs, a chain store in California, where people are breaking in, burglarizing them so they can steal the Lego and accessories. There was a case where they were relieved of $100,000 worth of these things.
Wow.
So it's quite hot. It's actually, most of this is being driven by adults buying these things, not children. Also, the Five Little Monkeys, a toy store, which has a lot of Lego things. They are having similar problems with things being stolen, so they're quite valuable. I mean, think twice between assuming any Lego of any kind you have is worthless, because it's not.
Wow.
That's not all worth as much as these recent sets and the detailed ones. They're sort of like descendants of what, when I was a kid, 50 and 60, well, more than 50 years ago, 60 years ago, there were models where you would make airplanes and cars and trains and that sort of thing. And in a way, the Lego sets are like that now. You buy kits that will let you create a Star Wars spacecraft or something like that. It has all the specific parts. So those are the things that often are turning out to be worth remarkable amounts of money to the people who really want to get them.
Well, we just had the basic Lego building blocks when I was a kid, but maybe I should check the attic anyway.
Yes, well, there was no concept. I mean, Lego was very much around in the 60s, but there was no concept of making of anything that was pre-designed to make any one thing. You just had to use your imagination and your skill and your experimentation to make something that looked like a tower or a car or whatever.
Right, right. Well, as we alluded to earlier, it looks like the stock market is jumping, surging after that China-U.S. agreement to temporary cut tariffs. What's going on with the markets and numbers elsewhere this morning?
Well, we have some big changes here. Okay, for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, over the past week, it lost 68 points. For the week ending early this morning, the NASDAQ was quite similar, losing 49 points. But just this morning, the Dow is at, right now, or as of a 10-minute delay here, about 42,280, which is just over 1,000 more than it was early this morning. NASDAQ 18,594, about 600 and some more than it was early this morning. So they had quiet weeks, but now they're jumping way up. Other prices, and I'm going to give you the early in the morning, the early in the morning ones on these now. Other changes are not nearly as big, but gold, 3225, lost 62 over the week, almost $100 down. It's really on the here today, gone tomorrow tariff news that's affecting people around the world. Silver, 3216, down 23 cents, not as much for a ratio of just over 100 to 1. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, jumped $5.76, which just about canceled out last week's loss. So it's still quite low, but it's now about the same as it was 2 weeks ago. Bitcoin, $104,469, up almost $10,000. That's surprising. But more confidence, people have more confidence in Bitcoin than they did last week, and probably people buying fed on other people buying and so on. The dollar got stronger, as indicated by the British pound, 1.3197, down about a penny, and the euro down 2 cents to 1.1133. The Japanese 100 yen dropped another penny to go back to its typical 2024 and 25 territory of 68 cents. Otherwise, well, it's so much of this is really up to our president's whim, so we have no idea what's going to happen in the future. But they did love the Chinese tariffs being partially lifted. So if you can figure it out from there, more power to you.
Exactly. Well, James B. Huntington, local economist and author, thanks for joining us this morning. And I understand you're taking a little bit of a break. Then we've got Memorial Day, so we'll see you in a few weeks.
Yes, I'll be back in 3 weeks.
All right,
James. Have fun, everyone.
Thank you, sir. Right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll find out what's going on at the Liberty Theater here in Liberty, New York. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, creating a new musical is a high-stakes gamble that can take years to pay off.
One wrong decision, you're dead and you don't know it.
So what does it take to actually get a show to Broadway?
I do think there's something about the process that is insane.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering 4 counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, if you've been on social media locally lately, chances are you've seen the name Cats pop up again and again. But it's not the Broadway musical or your neighbor's Tabby. It stands for Catskill Arts and Theater Space. And it's tied to an effort to revive one of Sullivan County's most iconic buildings, the Liberty Theater, just down the road from us here at the studios. So what's happening behind those historic doors? Let's find out with co-artistic directors of Catskill Arts and Theater Space, Eloise Kidman and Harold Ty, to talk about plans and progress and why Liberty deserves a stage of its own. Good morning. How are you guys?
Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having us on.
Yes, of course. So let's tell me more. What exactly is going on at the Liberty Theater with Cats, Eloise?
So we have obviously been in talks with Bruce Davidson, who's done an amazing job at renovations. And we have kind of taken the key to the theater, and we're hoping to create something new in that space. We hope to become a true portal to the arts, a place where our community can come together, experience, create, and celebrate arts in all of its forms. We would like to be a beacon for change in our area, so not just restoring the space, but building a working and educational theater that offers real opportunities right here in Sullivan County.
Yes, and Bruce has been kind enough. We've been working with him for the last couple of months, and one of the issues that we're going to have right away is that we're getting a huge concrete box is what we're getting, you know, with, you know, complete. It's a beautiful renovation, but there's no theater stuff. There's no lights. There's no sound. There's only a few seats, you know, et cetera.
Right. So for those of us who've seen it from the outside, they've got the new marquee, which has been restored out there on Main Street. Looks really pretty. But inside, it's just a shell, and you guys are going to build that out.
We're going to build that out. Go ahead, Eloise.
Sorry.
That's all right.
So part of what we've been kind of doing the last few weeks since taking it over is reaching out to different people. And we had a very productive meeting with BOCES. And they have their construction department, you know, where they teach our local children, you know, tools, trades and things. And they have agreed to help us with the building out of the stage and things such as this once we have been able to raise funds for the necessary materials. You know, and that's just a testament to the fantastic programs available for our kids in the area. And we just hope to add to that. So right now, you know, we're focusing on our fundraising efforts. Hudson Valley Gives is soon, and we've registered for that. Just to try and raise the funds to, you know, reupholster chairs, do flooring, sound, lighting, and things such as that, really.
This sounds like it's an exciting proposal to have another theater company, especially right there in Liberty. What's the timeline you're looking at here as you're talking about fundraising and getting started with construction? When can folks expect to see some events and programming there?
Probably next year sometime. Okay, we'll be able to start putting on some small events. We're gonna one of the things that we're doing to raise some cash is we're gonna be opening up a Liberty Cafe. Okay, right there in the front of the theater. So that'll help us with a little cash flow. But we're hoping that what we'll be able to do is bring in local artists, local shows. produce some of our own shows, et cetera. So,
Eloise, did you want to add to that?
Yeah. So, as Howard said, we're trying to open our lobby foyer space to be like a community space where people can come in. It's going to be an art-themed space where people can come in and get involved with different programmings that are happening, kids programs, making things, have a cup of tea and a chat and get to know our neighbors whilst we're doing everything. And, you know, we hope that into next year we can have more programming. At the end of the summer, we hope to start our own community theater for the area, where we would look at partnering with SUNY Sullivan and using their stage in the meantime whilst we kit ours out. So we had a meeting with them about the possibility of us using that space. And we hope that in our lobby space, we will be able to put on some smaller events for the community, because everyone has been so patiently waiting. And obviously renovations can take such a long time whilst you're waiting on different people to do different things. And as I said, people are patiently waiting and want to get involved. So we're trying to make sure that they can be involved as soon as possible, really, by opening up this space to them and open mic and poetry nights and things such as that, really.
Harold, you're known in the local theater community. In fact, you're sitting across from me now wearing a T-shirt for the Forestburg Playhouse and a jacket with the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop, a couple of great theater companies here already. What makes this project, this group, different from some other theater companies that are in the area?
Well, for one, we're going to be we'll be less of a producing company and more of a production company. So, what I mean by that is we'll be hosting a lot of events, and we'll be actually producing, making some of our own events on a much smaller scale. Okay, because what we really want to try to do is fill that space as often as possible. As many people who are involved in theater know, you just can't make it just on tickets, you know, and so you have to use your space wisely and that sort of thing. And there are several of the theater entrepreneurs in the area who would more than agree with me on that, since I've talked to almost all of them.
What do you say to folks who think their area already has enough theater groups or arts groups?
Well, go ahead, Eloise.
I don't think you can really ever have enough, because every area offers something different, and we're in a community where maybe people can't easily get to other places, and they need something in their hometown. And what we're trying to do is not just be a community theater. Is we want to be a center where we formed this Catskills Performers Collective, and we're reaching out to performers, groups, theaters, musicians, artists, and saying, come and join us. And we've had an amazing response, and everyone will be using our space. Everyone that joins us can use our space, can showcase what they do. And for us, it's about the educational side. It's about being a fully working and educational hub. So not only generating employment, but actually helping to give qualifications and educational qualifications to those who maybe wish to have a future in the arts in some way, be it on stage or be it technically. You know, so I think that separates us a little bit. We are not just going to be a community theater. We are going to be a hub for everybody, whether you're in Liberty or further. We welcome everybody into that space.
How can the community get involved, learn more? Where can they get more information about this effort at the Catskill Arts?
We have our website, which is very new. We're still tinkering away at it, but it's thelibertytheatre.com. We are on Facebook, the same name. TikTok, we're just starting. That's definitely something for the younger generation, but I'm trying. And we're, like I said, we're about to do Hudson Valley Gives. They can email us info@thelibertytheatre.com. And, you know, they can get involved in so many different ways, whether they want to join us for our community theater, if they want to volunteer their time. We're really open right now to suggestions, to everyone really having a say in what we do here.
And final thoughts here. What do you hope folks feel when they walk through the doors of the Liberty Theater again?
Well, what we want them to feel is we get so many people, you know, at Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop who walk in and say, I remember going to movies here. You know, I remember doing this.
Yeah.
I remember being chased out of the balcony here. You know, that sort of thing. And we want them to walk in and have really kind of two feelings. One is, oh, this is a comfortable place. This is a place that I've been before, and it's been refurbished, okay? But it's also someplace that's cutting edge, something that is going to be, you know, we're not going to be constantly presenting, you know, musicals from, you know, the mid-40s or something. We're going to be doing stuff that's new and exciting and uses local artists and local playwrights and local singers and musicians and things like that, and poets. There's a lot of talent in Sullivan County, as those of us who are involved in the arts know. And we want someplace that they can all kind of gather.
Well, Eloise Kidman and Harold Tai, co-artistic directors of Catskill Arts and Theater Space, Cats, reviving the Liberty Theater there, Main Street and Liberty, giving it a nice shot in the arm there for the redevelopment of Main Street there, and also for our theater community throughout the whole region. Thank you both so much.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we've got some hope and some joy. Dr. Hope Blecker is here. This is Radio Catskill.
This is Ari Shapiro with NPR. If you've been thinking about helping this station with a contribution, but now is not the right time for a financial gift, you can donate a vehicle you don't need. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Think about it. And thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Dr. Hope Blecker is an educator, author, artist, and dedicated community volunteer whose work spans nearly four decades and countless lives touched. And she is here with an update on the many things that she's working on. I've tried to like boil it down here, but you have so many things that you're working on. Hi, thanks for coming back in again.
I am happy, happy to be here. It's a pleasure. I always feel welcome here. So thank you so
much. Well, thank you for all you do. You have a lot of community impact through a lot of the different things that you do in our area. One of them is Hope's Compass. If you could just remind folks about Hope's Compass.
So Hope's Compass is the nonprofit that I formed so that I could bring these projects to the community. And it is through arts and through literature. And last year we had Voices of Survivors. This year we have Honoring Survivors. So all the things blend into this nonprofit for the community.
You also have a speaker series. Tell us a little bit about that and the online presence that you have for it.
So we have the Honoring Survivors and Their Rescuers Through the Generations, and that is the outgrowth of last year, the Voices of Survivors. And from that, we have a series of videos. We are releasing one a week. Thank you to WJFF. You are a champion that came through for us with the recordings. And every week, one will be released ongoing through the summer.
And
so
where's
we will
that?
Be adding
where
them.
Can folks see those?
And people can find those at the YouTube channel. That is the YouTube channel at Hope's Compass.
And let's talk about the Daffodil Project. We've had you on before about that, and maybe we do every time this year, I guess, right?
Probably, yes, yes. They look beautiful.
They do. Remind folks about the Daffodil Project and an update locally.
So the update for that is September 28th. On a Sunday, we will be having our largest daffodil garden in the area to date. We will be planting 3,000 daffodils at Morningside Park. Harris is championing it at Morningside Park in Fallsburg. We'll be doing it that Sunday morning, and we have a benefactor who is donating a marker for us, and that is done to commemorate the children who perished in the Holocaust.
And this is a project that's you've been working on for several years,
yes.
And it's expanding this further. It's got to be really meaningful.
And it is beautiful. It is a worldwide project,
yeah.
So it is called the daffodilproject.net. And when you go online and see their pictures, they just had celebrated the 1,000,000th daffodil.
Mm.
So the video that they created for that, and if you look, you will see that we are there. So Liberty is there represented in their montage. It's very nice. And we've had children that have come. We've had people from 5 to 85. And we've had artwork that came out of that project. And that artwork is on display currently at the Government Center in Monticello.
Let's talk about the little libraries and creation stations. What inspired those and how are they supported by the community?
So that was really inspired by the voices of survivors. For me personally, yeah. It was inspired by voices of survivors because so much of what they had was burned and destroyed. And I thought, wow, if we have these little libraries and creation stations, that's a way that we keep stories alive and accessible to anyone who drives by, walks by. So little free libraries have existed for about 15, 20 years. But for me, bringing them here spawned from that other project. Mm-hmm. And so right now I'm doing fundraising for hopescompass.org. And I have a special incentive. If anyone donates a dollar amount that has a four, so $14, $24, $44, $400 maybe, they will be entered into a prize pool to win a four-pack Monster Golf, cart included.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, for your four, they get a foursome. And so that is really a way. They're about $500 to purchase and install through the Little Library organization.
And where are they located? Just a few places around.
So we will be having one that we will be – the first one in Parksville will be at the corner of Main and Short Street, where the pharmacy building is. So Sarah Litwin is going to be the steward of it. Mm-hmm. And then we hope to have another one, Chief DeGatta, through the Liberty Rotary. He is going to adopt one, and that's donated by Liberty Rotary, and that will go outside the police department as part of their outreach.
Here in Liberty.
Yes. And then we hope – I've been speaking with James Guara at Parks and Rec, and we hope to have one at Walnut Mountain as part of their renovation and pathway there so people can take the hike and then come and – find their creation station.
And as if you weren't doing enough, you're also an author. You're in the volume 5 of Mission Hope, which is a larger project.
Yes.
Has your name in it. But
yes.
You're
it has
in
my name
it.
In it. I'm in it, but I am not it.
Right. And the theme of this Mission Hope collection of stories and essays is called Joy.
Yes. So this last one is Joy. And for people who have read the other two or have received copies or seen my collaboration along with many others, for the Joy one, I actually wrote a poem. So it is not a narrative. It is a way to experience joy through poetry. And I was just telling Mimi about that as before I came in here. So surprise, surprise, you'll get it. And it's going to be released in, I believe the publisher said, within the next 2 weeks.
And is there a recognition that you received recently as well should mention?
Oh, thank you. So I was surprisingly recognized as an ambassador for good. So that came out of Biz Catalyst, and it's a project by Dennis Patoko. He's based in Florida, and he kudos to him. He just became recognized as one of the big contributors on that platform. And I woke up one day and there it was. Hope, we have selected you for our inaugural class of ambassadors for good who do projects, bring people together.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Oh, okay. Thank you.
I mean, it's an apt recognition and an apt title. You
thank
are an
you.
Ambassador for good. You're always a bright light in the community and always bringing us great things. We ran through a list of a lot of the things that you're working on. We don't have time to get to one more. Liberty Museum and Arts Center you're involved with as well. They have some upcoming exhibits. Where can folks go to get more information quickly there?
So they could find out that the Liberty Museum and Arts Center, or they can look at my website, drhopeshub.org, where I have brought together all the different facets of hope.
Got the whole hope in one
The whole hope became a hub. That's it. I became a hope hub. That's it. I needed to for myself and everybody else. So drhopeshub.org.
Dr. Hope Blecker, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear our program and all of our local programs at our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, I ask that you go to protectmypublicmedia.org to ensure the future of Radio Catskill and all public media. It's under threat. So go to the website. You'll see the button. Add your name to the voices who want to preserve public radio for all. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jason Dole. The White House, you may have heard, has proposed eliminating federal funding for public media in its budget, issued an executive order to block support for PBS and NPR, and wants to claw back funding that Congress already approved. The threat to public media is real, it's here, and it is growing. The stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org. That's protectmypublicmedia.org. And tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, another pleasant day on tap, but the rain is coming back into the forecast. Today, partly sunny with a high of 74. Slight chance of a rain shower overnight, 51 for the low. Tomorrow, light rain developing later in the day and then continuing through the evening and overnight and into the morning Wednesday. Tomorrow's high, 66.